children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This morning, we're bringing you programs from the Focus 580 archive. So do remember, as you listen, we'll not be taking your calls. Human beings have admired, collected, sometimes lusted over diamonds for thousands of years. Today, in the United States, diamonds are a big business. In fact, a $25 billion business. And we are told that 7 out of every 10 American women own at least one diamond. At the same time, you have to acknowledge that diamonds are not particularly rare in nature. And while they may have their industrial uses, the only reason that people are willing to pay tens of thousands or more for a big gem-quality diamond is that they've decided that it's worth that much. One of the questions that we'll take on this morning in this part of Focus 580 is that very question. Why is it that this fairly common mineral is something that has become so highly prized and highly valued? And our guest for this hour of the show is Tom Zollner. He has worked as a contributing editor for Men's Health magazine, also as a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he is the author of a newly published book that is titled The Heartless Stone, A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire. It's published by St. Martin's Press. And the book takes a look at how diamonds are mined, how they're cut, how they're sold, and why it is that some people will pay so much to own one of these sparkly minerals. Mr. Zollner, hello.
Morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. You explain in the book that your interest in diamonds, or at least trying to find out more about them, where they come from, how they're handled, why we value them so much, comes from some personal experience that you bought, like a lot of other guys, you bought a diamond engagement ring for someone.
Yeah, you know, I went through that ritual as 1.7 million American guys do every year, of going to buy an engagement ring for the woman they intend to marry. And that ring, we never did get married. That ring was given back to me. And when I first began to look at the diamond trade, I also couldn't help but look into my own self and, you know, wonder, well, why was it that I felt compelled to do that, to buy that ring? And, you know, the more I looked at this, you know, fairly dismal industry, you know, the more I began to wonder about this concept of value, why we choose to value and place these surrogate feelings onto inanimate objects.
Yeah. Well, certainly people have placed high value on diamonds going back a long time in Asia and in Europe. It's interesting, though, that this tradition of giving a diamond engagement ring has only dates for most people, particularly in this country, only dates from a little bit before World War II, and it was a classic case study in marketing skill that the company that did it on behalf of De Beers, the big diamond company in South Africa, managed to create this campaign persuading people to do something that previously they simply hadn't done.
Yeah, this is one of the greatest marketing stories of all time. Prior to the 1930s, you know, diamonds were really, in this country, regarded as an extravagance and something that was almost even tacky. You know, they were associated with stuffed shirts and aristocrats and gangsters, and, you know, certainly nothing that the common person would really want or need, you know. And so, you know, diamond engagement rings were not unheard of, but they were certainly not the norm until 1938, which was the pivotal year. That's when De Beers launched a series of very brilliant, very calculating advertisements at the American public, telling them that the diamond ring was a cultural imperative for marriage. And that, you know, throughout history, men have been giving rings to their sweethearts before marriage, when really they hadn't. This was invented history. And it nonetheless convinced, you know, the broad swath of Americans that, hey, you know, we really buy into this. And a phony tradition, quote-unquote, was concocted that a man must spend 2 months of his annual salary on the ring. That was created out of whole cloth. Mm-hmm. is sort of a sliding scale. You know, everyone could participate from the company president on down to the janitor.
And they did it. They did the same thing in Britain. And amazingly enough, one of the places that they did it, and it worked very, very well, was in Japan, where there certainly had been no tradition of a diamond engagement ring. And it worked so well that I think, if I remember right, what it says in the book is that now the Japanese are, Japan is one of the biggest buyers of diamonds, or maybe the biggest market for diamonds in the world.
Yeah, you know, also a tremendous marketing story. Diamonds were unheard of in Japan prior to the 1960s, and De Beers went in and managed to, through the power of advertising, through the power of pressure, the collective pressure, you essentially remade the wedding ceremony and the courtship ritual in Japan to accommodate the diamond ring, to accommodate the proposal of marriage, the romantic proposal of marriage, which in that culture really was something that was not widely done. This was a culture where arranged marriages were the norm, and the sense of pursuit-based courtship that we're so familiar with here in the United States was really, you know, not done in Japan until De Beers got their, you know, got their idea that here's a great place to sell diamond rings.
Yeah.
And it took off beyond anyone's expectations, and you know, diamond ring consumption among Japanese brides went from 1% in 1966 all the way to 90% 30 years later.
I like to also, you mentioned the fact that as part of this campaign here in the United States, the ad agency that was working for De Beers said to young men, or I guess men of any age, that we're going to get married, that you need to buy this diamond ring for a fiancé, and your good rule of thumb as to how much you should spend is 2 months' salary. Apparently, they also did the same thing in Britain, but they thought that the British men were a bit more stingy, and so they said to them, okay, 1 month, but the Japanese, they figured they could push them, and they told the Japanese 3 months.
Exactly. It shows you, you know, the malleability of what they think they can get out of a particular culture. A particularly amusing example of how, you know, that the cultural imperative was created out of whole cloth.
You spent some time, you traveled around the country to, you traveled around the country, but you also traveled around the world going to some of the places that are known as diamond producers. Most of the diamonds, I guess, about half, come from Africa, but also diamonds come from Canada, from Russia, from South America.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we could do a little bit of Geology 101, and you could talk about exactly what, in geological terms, what a diamond is and how diamonds come to be.
Yeah, you know, a diamond is nothing more than a piece of carbon, you know, that has been squeezed and heated in such a way that the atoms decouple and relock into a 36-atom bond shaped like a cube. This is one of the hardest, you know, collection of atoms known in nature. And most of these diamonds were formed in the Earth's mantle and then brought up to the surface of the Earth through a special type of volcano containing a clay called kimberlite. This is the host rock of diamonds. And so, you know, there's two ways to get at that, those little tiny pieces of pressurized carbon. You either dig straight down into the core of that ancient volcano, which, you know, they don't look like mountains. You know, they've been flattened out, and they're basically hiding under the earth at various flat locations around the world. So you either dig down into that, which requires heavy capitalization, a lot of machinery, a sophisticated milling operation to separate the ore from the actual diamond. You have to crush up 250 tons on average of ore to get at 1 carat of diamond. So it's sort of a needle in a haystack hunt. That's one way to do it, and this, of course, you know, only a big corporation with a lot of cash can do that. The other way you mine for diamonds is what's called alluvial mining, which anybody can do, as long as they've got a shovel and some determination. And what you do is you simply find either a river or the ghost of an ancient river, and you dig into the sand, and you try and find one of those carats that's been washed out of the core of an ancient volcano and perhaps carried hundreds of miles away from its original birthing spot. This type of mining is widespread in Africa. It's very hard to control, and this is the locus of the problem known as blood diamonds. You know, because you know these river sites are so common across the African continent, they become military targets. And these diamonds become excellent ways to finance a civil uprising. They're used to buy rifles and landmines from Eastern European arms dealers, and they keep these civil conflicts going in Africa when, you know, they ordinarily would have no other source of finance. You know, a diamond is a wonderful way to smuggle a lot of money across a national border. They're very small. There's simply no better way to pack a large amount of wealth into a tiny package than in a diamond. And so, the symbol of love that has been propped up by such brilliant advertising and which has been sold to not just Americans but to people all over the world as being the thing that you've got to have, you know, to basically be a heart outside of your heart. I mean, it really could have a very dismal history to it. That same stone could have easily been killed for, slain for, used to buy AK-47s. It's a case study in the gulf in between something that claims to be something but really is something else.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, Tom Zollner. He's a writer. He's authored a new book that is about diamonds, why it is that people value them, where they come from, how they're processed, how they're sold. His book is The Heartless Stone, A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire, and it's published by St. Martin's Press. Should be able to find it in the bookstore. Questions are also welcome here on the program, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Given that now this aspect of diamonds, at least diamonds that come from some places, has been highlighted by the media and people have heard the phrase blood diamonds or conflict diamonds, has that either cut into the market for diamonds? Does that make some people say, well, I don't want to have anything to do with them at all? Or has that also been good for the diamond industries in other countries like Canada, for example, where the diamonds don't have that kind of baggage?
You know, there are gradually more and more people becoming aware that there is a link between, you know, these glittering pieces of carbon and, you know, the great misery in the places where they're mined. There was one survey a couple of years ago that showed that 30% of customers were, you know, at least vaguely aware of a problem with conflict diamonds or blood diamonds, and that 20% of diamond consumers would be willing to make an actual buying decision based on that knowledge. You raised the question about other nations that are at peace and do have tough environmental laws, and where these diamonds do have some sort of a patina of social responsibility around them, such as Canada. And there's been a real debate in those nations as to how much they want to emphasize how their stones are different. And this also, I think, gets to the heart of the diamond question, which is that a diamond without that mythology that surrounds it is essentially empty. I mean, it's a really silly product. It's basically just a stone that happens to kind of sparkle nicely when you polish it. I mean, you know, big deal. So without that mythology, it's worthless. If Canada goes to the thinking, if they really go out of their way to point to this big blood diamond problem in Africa and emphasize the purity and the quality of their own stones, they wind up shooting themselves in the foot because they tear down the idea of a diamond in general. And the diamond, all it has going for it is that idea, is that sort of intellectual core of, you know, this is the mark of luxury, this is the mark of love, these very soft values. And so if they taint that, if they, you know, throw a bucket of blood on it, if you will, they harm their own product.
That gets to this interesting question about why it is that people place value on diamonds at all, because if it was merely that they were pretty and sparkly and dramatic and catch the light the way that they do, then you can make some for a fraction of the cost, you can make something synthetically that will do the same thing if that's all you wanted. So obviously there's got to be, and there are some people who might say that was just fine, but obviously it's not the same. And if you could do that, then nobody in their right mind would pay $25,000 or more for some great big chunk of diamond when you could have somebody make you one for, I don't know how much, a few hundred or maybe a few thousand.
Yeah, you know, that really does get to the heart of the question. There's something weird going on in our minds when it comes to diamonds. You know, we're really particular and funny about them. You know, when I was trying to, you know, finally get rid of the stone left over from my broken engagement, you know, I asked a number of my female friends, you know, this hypothetical question. You know, let's say that you meet the guy of your dreams, and he's perfect in every way, and, you know, you just can't believe that you'd found such a perfect soulmate. But then he wants to marry you, and he says, listen, I've got this stone left over from, you know, my ex-marriage, you know, my ex-wife or my ex-fiance, and I'd really like to, you know, to wipe those memories clean and to give the stone to you and to create a whole new meaning around that stone. You know, what do you say? To a woman, all of my friends said, "What, are you kidding? Never! You know, I could never take that rock." And you know, and I totally understand. I mean, I absolutely agree with them. You know, no one should have to do that. But you know, you really have to ask, well, why? You know, that stone isn't used. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, the guy is really the used goods. You know, he's the one who was indelibly imprinted with memories of the other relationship. You know. But the rock is empty. The rock has no, you know, cerebral cortex. It should be just fine, but somehow it's not. And I totally understand that. And you know, that kind of illustrates for me also this weird way we have of projecting our dreams and our values onto that inanimate object. And in the case of diamonds, it's a particularly silly object.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I guess that also goes to some way to explaining why it is that, in spite of the fact that diamonds are virtually indestructible, one of the things that De Beers has sold them by saying the diamond is forever, in spite of that fact, apparently there's not much of a market for pre-owned diamonds. You'd think that that diamonds could be resold, and that some people would maybe even think, well, that's great. If I could get a deal on a diamond, it's just as good now as it ever was. Just because somebody else wore it before, you know, so what? But apparently, there isn't much of a market for pre-owned diamonds.
That's absolutely right. There is no secondary market, really. I mean, it does exist, but it's really you know, moribund and flat. And you know, a bunch of used diamonds floating around is the last thing that De Beers wants. I mean, that would really cut into their market share. I mean, they want people to buy those diamonds once and then hold on to them forever. And you know, that's the other, you know, really brilliant insight with this link with love and commitment. You know, those diamonds become very hard to get rid of, as I found out myself. I mean, even after all the really, you know, dismal things I was finding out about this industry, I still was really reluctant to part with the ring that I had given Anne, my ex-fiance.
So is it the case then that diamonds end up, you have to ask the question, what happens to them? I'm sure people don't throw them away. It must be that a lot of them end up being passed down through families from, no doubt, from woman to woman they end up getting passed, mostly, I guess.
Yeah, certainly. And everyone, I think, knows of someone, or, you know, perhaps even did it themselves, where, you know, the engagement ring that they gave or received was a family heirloom.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here. We'd welcome others. 333-9455 for Champaign Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Here's someone calling on a cell phone from Savoy. And here's the caller here, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Another interesting program.
Sure.
Just a couple of quick points, quick observations. And since I'm on a cell, I'll go ahead and ring off. Interestingly enough, you guys just touched on a point. My wife and I have been married for 20 years, and when we were engaged, my mother gave me her ring to give to my wife, and it fit my wife's finger perfectly, and she was enthralled by that, and obviously, well, 20 years, I guess it's worked out. But I was curious as to the one point you were touched on. Once you buy the diamond from a retailer, like a car, and if something did happen, I'm guessing because of all the marketing and all the markup that if they probably, number one, would never rebuy that diamond, or number two, if they did, it would be a greatly reduced price. And then the other thing I wanted to comment on is maybe your guest can comment on this down the road, is the way the diamonds are allotted. I believe, I want to say De Beers out in London, basically comes in to a room with a handkerchief full of diamonds, and if you're a broker, they say, okay, this is your allotment, and that's the beginning, end, and all of it. I mean, you take that and you walk out the door, or you walk out the door with nothing. And then the last comment I had was, I was wondering if your guests would see any correlation between the diamond industry and perhaps where the fur market was 10, 15 years ago. I do believe with your guest that the marketing is so ingenious and the economy is built up so fantastic around the industry that there's no way it can be allowed to fall apart. But I was surprised to see the public interest and public knowledge in basically bringing down the fur market. And I just thought I'd make those observations. Go ahead and hang up, and thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the questions.
Yeah, those are all great points and all with a lot of substance to them. And I'll take number two first. That the color is absolutely correct. I mean, De Beers, what they do is they fly 80 to 90 of the world's most powerful diamond brokers to London 10 times out of every year to events called sites. And these are, really very kind of antiquated rituals, but they still determine, the worldwide price of diamonds. These guys are taken to the second floor of a fairly bland-looking building in the Holborn neighborhood of London, and they're given not handkerchiefs full, but suitcases full of diamonds. Actually, they look like Craftsman lunchboxes. I saw a couple of them. They're orange and black, and they would look completely in place at a construction site. And inside these suitcases are anywhere from $1 million to $30 million worth of diamonds. And there's a show of haggling, but really the absolute choice is take it or leave it. And nobody ever leaves it, because to do so would be to risk disinvitation from future sites. And, if you get to be one of these guys who's invited to a De Beers site, you are guaranteed a smashing profit, and no one wants to say no to that. Remind me, what was the third question there?
He was making this connection, or suggesting there might be a connection between maybe the fact that, and here's what I understand what the caller was saying, that people have started to turn away from fur.
Yes.
And because of all of the negative associations with producing it. And it seemed that his question was, diamonds and the diamond industry certainly has some negatives too. Is there any possibility, you think, that maybe over time and in the future, that more people would say, it's not something I need, it's not something I want, I don't want to be a party to how they're produced, and so I don't care to have a diamond ring?
Yeah, that is a great point. And there was a point almost of critical mass in 1998 when it became apparent that the blood diamond problem was spinning out of hand. The United Nations became aware of it. Humanitarian groups began to, really make a lot of noise, and the industry realized, if we don't do something about this, we are going to become, as one guy put it to me, another fur. And they, looked at what PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, had successfully done with fur and made it a social taboo almost to go around wearing an animal pelt. And that was the last thing they wanted to see. And so, under great pressure from the UN and under tremendous fear that their product would become sullied, they formed a process to try and get a handle on the flow of blood diamonds. This is called the Kimberley process. And what it says is that, if you're exporting diamonds from any nation, they have to be in a tamper-proof container with a certificate, swearing that they were not mined in a war zone. It's a step in the right direction, but it's a very superficial process full of loopholes. Diamonds from these conflict zones are still making it to the marketplace, and it's been criticized as largely a PR effort. And I think there's some merit to that argument, because whenever confronted with the dirty laundry in its own shop, the industry has historically chosen to go on a huge PR offensive and never really do anything about the underlying problems of the business. And this is a case where the problems still continue. As I say, it's very easy to get around the Kimberley process. You either smuggle the diamond across an international border, or, the other big problem is that, a nation need not be in a technical state of civil war as defined by the United Nations to still have a lot of really bloody, awful, miserable conditions in those diamond mines. And these stones are still making their way to market, unbeknownst to the consumer. And in some ways it's worse, because there's this sort of superficial little, certificate, putting a blessing on it, when really, you still have no way of knowing if your stone is those, estimated 1% to 3% of stones that are coming from a conflict zone.
Hmm.
So, yes, the danger is there for the industry that there will be another rise in public, distaste for this.
Yeah. Just and real quick, the first question the caller asked, if he posed this hypothetical situation, you go to a jeweler, you buy a diamond, for whatever reason you decide you don't want it, and you go back to the person and said, look, I don't need this diamond. Can I return it? Will you buy it back? Will jewelers buy them back?
Sure, at a tremendously reduced cost. I mean, anyone who buys a diamond thinking that they can return it for same amount of cash back, or perhaps even as an investment. I mean, that would be a really bad decision, because the analogy is like that of driving a car off of a lot. The instant you do that, that car immediately depreciates, significantly in value. It becomes used at that point. Even though it's still in pristine condition, you're in for a loss. I myself took a 20% loss on my stone that I finally got the nerve to sell back to the jeweler.
Our guest, Tom Zollner, has worked as contributing editor for Men's Health magazine, also as a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. He is, in addition, the co-author of An Ordinary Man. That's the autobiography of the Rwandan hotel manager, Paul Rusesabagina, the guy whose story is told in Hotel Rwanda. Maybe you're familiar with that. He's also now author of a new book that is about diamonds, where they come from, and why we value them so highly, why some people value them so highly. The book is The Heartless Stone, A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire. It's published by St. Martin's Press. And other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, this is just a comment. I thought, based on your earlier discussion, that when you're engaged, you would say that you didn't believe in a diamond. It'd be sort of a kiss of death, you know. I think you probably wouldn't go much further unless you had the right partner, I would assume.
Not sure I understand the question.
No. What I was getting at, you were talking about in terms of, the passing down of diamonds and such, but in terms of if you're engaged, in other words, the tradition of a diamond, given the diamond for the engagement, and you would tell, in other words, the person you're engaged to, that you didn't believe in diamonds, that kind of stuff, because of the industry, I'm not too sure how many women would go along with being engaged to you, or even to marry you. I'm not sure.
Yeah, interesting. Diamonds purport to be a holding place of value in some ways. They this mythology surrounding them, that these are the marks of commitment, This is a way to sort of materialize the unmaterial. In other words, a diamond is supposed to represent the really, really important things that make a marriage work. That sense of self-sacrifice and of commitment and of being a supportive partner and so forth. And so, in some ways, they're sort of a false idol. A false representation of the things that are really important.
Mm-hmm.
It's natural that we do this. I mean, I think humans, it's just part of being alive, almost, that we yearn for those, things that are eternal, that we can actually hold in our hands, that we can actually see. I mean, these are very difficult things to talk about in a lot of ways. I mean, this is very sensitive and fragile territory in the human heart, this sense of commitment. And, in a sense, particularly for men, we are notoriously bad at expressing our feelings in a real way. I mean, women throughout history have known this and have dealt with it, just the way that we get tongue-tied about these things. And, a diamond becomes then, therefore, a convenient way to put it all in a shiny package and hand it over without having to, struggle too much.
Yeah, the symbol, in fact, there's been at the University of Illinois, there's a lot of research done by the whole myth of that, the engagement process and everything, academic research and that. But ties all these things into the diamond, But anyway, very interesting discussion.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Let's talk for a moment here about De Beers, this company that for a long time has dominated the diamond trade. I mentioned at the beginning, and you certainly mentioned in the book, that diamonds are not particularly rare in nature. One of the reasons they have become valuable, though, is that I think it's true to say that the people who market them, and De Beers would be the biggest one, has artificially restricted the supply.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and this is one of the hallmarks of De Beers. There are two big pillars holding up this historic corporation, and the first is that mythology, which it has so brilliantly manipulated. And the other is the artificial scarcity that you mentioned. It was the son of an Anglican minister named Cecil Rhodes, who's most remembered for endowing the Rhodes Scholarships at Oxford. You know, but he was the one who, in 1880s South Africa, figured out that the way to really make a fortune in diamonds is to basically buy out all the competitors and put all production under the umbrella of a giant corporation, and to then restrict the flow of those diamonds to the marketplace so that there would be no free market in diamonds, that diamonds would not suffer the vicissitudes of other commodities, you know, like wheat or copper or so forth. That, you know, what you paid for a diamond would be what De Beers says you should pay for a diamond. And this has been the thing that has dominated the diamond trade since 1889.
If you were walking along one of the places where diamonds were produced, and I know that you actually have done this, and you have seen rough diamonds, when a diamond comes out of the ground, what does it look like? And if you didn't know what a rough diamond was, would you pick it up and say, gee, that's nice, and put it in your pocket, or would you just kick it with the toe of your boot and think that it was just another rock?
Probably the latter. You know, like I saw many rough diamonds, and they are, you know, utterly unremarkable. You know, they look like little blobs of, you know, discolored tree sap, pieces of quartz. You know, they don't really cling to other rocks, you know, because of the molecular structure of a diamond. But, you know, really other than that, there's not a whole lot that would really catch your eye about a rough diamond. You know, it only does, you know, the light bouncing trick when you polish it a certain way.
Let's talk with someone here in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say, I guess I'm one of those women who never really cared about diamonds. My engagement ring is a garnet, and my husband and I have been married 30 years, and I don't know if half-jokingly or seriously, he swears he'll never buy me a diamond. And my sister, when I received my garnet as an engagement ring, used to tell people that her sister's diamond was a garnet. So it's so ingrained that your engagement ring is a diamond, people don't even stop to think about it.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I said earlier that, you know, we as people just have this ingrained ability, you know, sort of hardwired into our DNA almost, of projecting that meaning onto inanimate objects. And you can just as easily do that with, you know, really any stone that you choose to make your engagement stone. I mean, it could be a piece of gravel that you pluck off the driveway almost. And,
right.
You know, I think it's wonderful, actually, what you and your husband have done.
Well, it's, I guess one reason I never cared to have a diamond, and one reason is that they're so common. Everybody has a diamond, and I wanted something that was a little more unusual. So there are women out there, if you ask them, who are willing to forego a big diamond ring. So that's just for the men who think that women have to have diamonds. It's not necessarily so.
Right. Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. And you know, that's certainly a very good observation.
All right. Well, again, thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit, and perhaps you could talk some more about this advertising campaign that was paid for by the De Beers people to try to put into people's minds, men's minds particularly, that the greatest way that you could show your love, your lasting commitment for your prospective mate, your wife-to-be, would be to buy her a diamond ring, a diamond engagement ring. And this campaign that was carried out by this PR agency, NW Ayer & Son, had several facets, so to speak, and was really elegant. And again, it's a great case study in marketing. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the various aspects of this campaign.
Yeah, you know, the early ads in the 30s were, you know, very high-handed, very sober. You know, they hired Pablo Picasso and Salvador Dali to create original works of art that went alongside these magazine ads, which basically told the consumer that that they were going to die very shortly, the consumer, and that the only way to preserve a piece of their immortality was to buy a diamond. They were also told that their marriages would get dull and boring, and that their spouse was likely to cheat. and that, you know, the best way to capture the flame of their earlier love was in, guess what, a diamond. I mean, these were very, you know, strange ads, almost counterintuitive. You know, you'd think, well, you know, that's really no way to, you know, seduce a consumer by, you know, basically, you know, hinting at all these bleak things that are going to happen. But it worked. And, you know, the American lust for diamonds was ignited. You know, it went through a few strange permutations in the 1960s. You know, De Beers has always tried to be attuned to what's going on in the culture and try and make diamonds fit into that somehow. And, you know, when a new spirit about sexuality and marriage emerged, De Beers, you know, tried in some cases very clumsily to try and make diamonds sort of seem like a very cutting-edge, modern thing to do, and that, you know, almost a tool of women's liberation when, you know, really they were almost trying to deny the worship of marriage which they had promulgated for the, you know, all their previous ads.
Mm-hmm. Now, apparently they went as far as to try to persuade people in Hollywood to show diamonds in movies. They wanted to have celebrities wear them.
Yes.
So the notion of wearing diamonds got to be a cool, hip thing because people who were cool and hip wore them.
Yeah, and that's one thing that De Beers has always understood very well, is that there's no better way to steer the ship of American culture than through Hollywood and through you know, what we see on the big screen. And so they had a policy for many years that any studio that wanted to shoot a movie in which the starlet was going to wear some, you know, fabulous necklace or ring, you know, they would give them the stuff for free, basically. They would loan it out. They would suggest, you know, movie plots, you know, involving diamonds. They even went so far as to write sample lyrics for Broadway musicals and pass them on to the Tin Pan Alley lyricists in hopes that, you know, a diamond would become, you know, a centerpiece for a Hollywood musical. You know, and you see this icon popping up time and again in Hollywood movies through the decades. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is one of the famous examples. The James Bond movie Diamonds Are Forever. The Pink Panther, you know, the link in between diamonds and something kind of, you know, sexy and espionage-related and spy-like, you know, that is also never hurt the ultimate share price of a diamond. It only increases the intrigue around it.
Most of there are apparently every year large numbers of synthetic diamonds produced for industrial use. They're not gem quality, but they don't have to be, because they take advantage of the fact that diamonds are very hard and they can be used in all kinds of industrial cutting and grinding tasks. So it certainly is possible to make diamonds that would work for that. We talked a little earlier about the fact that maybe the appeal of the diamond wouldn't transfer to a synthetic gem quality diamond if you could do it. Apparently it is possible, or there are people who would like to do that. Is there really, you think there's really no chance that if someone came up with a way of producing synthetic gem quality diamonds, that there would be no market for those?
That market now exists. This technology was perfected in under the cover of the Soviet Union by some scientists in Siberia. I went out there actually to Siberia in January to see the warehouse where they had been created. I mean, you can now basically grow a beautiful, you know, canary yellow diamond the size of a garbanzo bean in a machine. And it takes 3 days, and you simply pour a scoop of graphite into a high pressure chamber that mimics the tremendous heat and pressure inside the Earth's mantle that, you know, is the birthplace for a natural diamond. And, you know, come back 3 days later, open up the top, and there's your perfect diamond. Atom for atom, it's a diamond. I mean, it's not cubic zirconia, it's not moissanite, it is a diamond. And this technology was bartered off and stolen after the Soviet Union disintegrated in 1989, and a company in Florida, for one, Gemesis, it's called, they acquired this technology through legitimate legal means, and they're now producing 500 carats of gem-quality diamonds, synthetic diamonds, in an industrial park in Sarasota, Florida, and selling them for a quarter of what you know, they would ordinarily cost. Hmm. And, they're, you know, turning a profit at this.
So right now, I think a one carat diamond average will cost you about $3,000, maybe something like that.
That's about right.
And it's interesting that as the size goes up, it's not an even progression. That is, to get a 2 carat diamond will cost you more than twice as much as the 1 carat, and it goes up from there. So to get a 1 carat synthetic diamond would only cost you what? I'm not very good at math.
It would cost you. I mean, they're making these diamonds right now only in yellow, which is actually a fairly rare form of diamond as it occurs in nature, and therefore more expensive. Ironically, in the synthetic process, it's easier to make a yellow diamond because of the slight amount of nitrogen impurities that create that color. But the rule of thumb is it's about 25% of the cost. And, this gets to the heart also of what it is about a diamond that makes it valuable. It's the poetry and it's the narrative behind it. And, I asked a De Beers guy, hey, aren't you guys worried about this process that essentially, like, blows away artificial scarcity? If you can stamp out diamonds, if you can essentially, like, just microwave a theoretically infinite number of them into existence, isn't that going to, really be sort of a not-so-great thing for you guys? And then, he did what other industry guys do when they're confronted with this question, and they go into what I might call full poetry mode. And he started going on about the eternal qualities of a natural diamond, and, created in the furnace of the earth, out of carbon, the same thing that man is created out of, and on, lauding the diamond to the skies as being this, natural work of art. And why would you want something that was created in a bucket in Florida? And it all comes down to, can the makers of synthetic diamonds essentially create a competing narrative, in a sense? I mean, can they weave enough poetry around their own stones that it'll seduce the minds of consumers into thinking that, hey, maybe I could, just as easily have a synthetic and it'd be just fine.
Mm-hmm. Our guest, Tom Zollner, he has worked as a contributing editor for Men's Health magazine, also reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, is author of the book The Heartless Stone, A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire, published by St. Martin's Press, which is about how diamonds are produced in the earth, how they're mined, how they are processed, how they are sold, and why it is that some people attach so much value to them. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked just a little earlier about the concerns that some people have about where the diamonds come from, about the conditions under which they're produced, about where the profits go. So we now have the term conflict diamond or blood diamond. And that as a way of trying to address that, there is this process, the Kimberley process, that is supposed to keep conflict diamonds off the market. But the fact of the matter is that I know a lot of people say it is an imperfect process. It doesn't work very well. And that it's still sometimes very difficult to tell where stones come from. There are apparently ways to either to tag them or to really establish their provenance in a way so that if that was your concern, that you would know exactly where that stone came from originally and through whose hands it had passed. Is there growing interest in being able to do that, and is the technology now getting to the point where you actually can do that?
Yeah, that would require that you polish the diamond at the mouth of the mine, essentially, and so that tag, if you will, would exist at the very start of the process instead of somewhere in the middle. And there are only a few mines in the world today that are actually doing that. That they have their polishing facilities located, very close to the mine site. Most of the polishing in this business is outsourced to the nation of India, where 92% of the world's diamonds are today cut and polished there in conditions that are, they vary along the spectrum. Some shops are well maintained and well ventilated. Others are, terrible and dingy and resemble sweatshops. And some of this work is being done by children. And, you know, this work is also can be very dangerous. The dust thrown up by that spinning wheel on which you polish a diamond, it's the hard metal dust from the wheel that is known to cause asthma and heart arrhythmia and other types of respiratory ailments.
So this, it's interesting that this the business of not only selling them but cutting and polishing that had been something that seemed to be a European enterprise for such a long period of time now has passed. And how did that happen? That India became the big center for cutting and polishing?
What happened was, and this really illustrates how this is really truly a global commerce and how there are interlocking parts to this business. What happened was that you know, De Beers' worst nightmare came true. A huge load of diamonds was discovered in Australia, and these were very small and dingy brown stones, but there were still just a massive amount of them. And De Beers did what it always does, which is to go on in and co-opt that discovery. They you know, sign an exclusive an agreement with the owners of the mine, and in the late 1990s, that relationship frayed. The Australians grew very impatient with De Beers for various reasons, and they decided to do something which had been unprecedented, which was to market these stones outside the control of the cartel. They needed a place to polish these diamonds, and they discovered India, which was an emerging industrial superpower. That they had, you know, legions of people willing to do this work for a very low cost. And so it's very much a globalization story. These Australian stones went to India and then were set into jewelry for sale in the American discount store market. Today, Walmart is the largest retailer of diamonds worldwide, and especially in the United States. And most of those stones are coming from Australia by way of India. And today, diamonds are India's fifth largest export product, and that's saying quite a bit in, you know, what is truly one of the roaring economic success stories of recent years.
Yeah, that's an amazing statistic. Although, given the kind of power of Walmart, they dominate so many kinds of retailing, so many sectors, that maybe it's not surprising, but. Again, the idea that now the largest diamond retailer in the United States is Walmart also tells you something about how far the buying of diamonds and the feeling that you have to buy it has penetrated from something that maybe at one time it would have been only the most wealthy people would do it and could do it, now to the point where it's very much something that people in the middle class, to the extent that they can afford it, are also doing it.
Oh, absolutely, and that it really shows you the democratization of this single idea that has kept this stone alive for so many years. You know, which is that, you know, this little mark, this little twinkling piece of carbon, you know, represents something more than what it actually is.
So back at the beginning, we talked about the fact that you started thinking about this, and this whole project, really, this book, comes out of the fact that. You had been engaged. You bought a diamond ring. That it didn't work out. Your fiance gave you the ring back, and you had that for a long time. Didn't really know what to do with it. Had invested so much in the relationship and in the possibility of getting married, and in that stone, that it took you a long time before you could finally say, "All right, I might as well see what I can get for this and move on." How long did it take you before you could? Take that diamond and go out and see what you could get for it.
A little more than 4 years. It was a difficult thing to do.
Even at that point, that was difficult? It was painful?
It was very difficult. And, you know, because that stone had really represented all the feelings I had had for my then-fiancé. And, you know, there was a great deal of love in that relationship. And, you know, even after I had really kind of divorced myself from this idea of a diamond being worth much of anything, you know, I still had to admit that, my gosh, you know, it really did become an enormous capturing device for, you know, the feelings that I had for her. And by letting go of that diamond, I was in some way letting go forever of that piece of her and that piece of myself that, you know, had been so happy with her. And so, you know, that's why, I mean, I don't think people are, you know, even after learning how I did about this fairly dismal industry, I don't think people are bad people for liking diamonds. And I don't even think the people who are in the business are bad people. You know, I met many, you know, quite, you know, wonderful, interesting, thoughtful people who were in the jewelry business. And so this product does have a certain hold, and I do understand it very, very keenly.
Yeah. So you wouldn't hold it against anybody who decided that they really had to have a diamond, that they had to give it to the person that they loved as a way of demonstrating that love. It's all something that maybe before, but now even more, you would say, yeah, I get that. I understand where that comes from.
Absolutely. I wouldn't hold him against it for a minute. I mean, I would not do the same thing myself. I would never buy another diamond, but nor do I look down on anyone who does, you know, want to have that.
Well, it's a very interesting book. There is more here than we really have discussed. It was a long trip here, and our guests spent a lot of time traveling around the world, including going to places where diamonds are mined. So if you're interested in all of the aspects of the story, you can, again, look at the book, The Heartless Stone, published by St. Martin's Press, by our guest, Tom Sulner. And thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a Focus 580 interview first broadcast earlier this year. It comes from the Focus Archives. If you'd like to hear some past programs you might have missed, or listen to interviews from the Afternoon Magazine or any other of our local production, you can go to that website anytime that you like. It's will.uiuc.edu. We hope that you will enjoy the rest of your day. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Boardman's Art Theater, now showing A Prairie Home Companion. Directed by Robert Altman and written by Garrison Keillor, A Prairie Home Companion features Meryl Streep, Lily Tomlin, Woody Harrelson, and Kevin Kline as Guy Noir. Showtime's available on the web at boardmansarttheater.com.
It's 2 minutes before 12 noon Central Time, and we're about ready to head into the Afternoon Magazine here on AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. Coming up, you'll get your chance to talk to Ed and get a custom forecast for wherever you may be going this upcoming weekend. And Ed says it will be an improving weekend. The end of our rain is coming, if it hasn't already in some places, north to south through the course of the day and through tonight. By the weekend, most of the area should see a good deal of sunshine and rather moderate seasonal temperatures. We will have the phone lines open coming up at about 12:45 this afternoon for Ed Kieser, a little before that, in fact. And in the 1 o'clock hour, we'll bring you an archived interview that Celeste Quinn did back in, I don't have that. It was earlier this year with an author, a sociologist, who has spent 2 decades talking with educators, parents, and other people about if and how sex ed should be part of the school curriculum. The book is called When Sex Goes to School. We'll hear that interview coming up at 1:06 this afternoon. Let's take a look at how commodities are doing on this last trading day of the week. A big sell-off, as USDA reports, had a bigger available crop than or a bigger expected crop than anticipated in the markets, and thus the wheat in Kansas City for September is down 11.25 cents a bushel right now at 4.58. September wheat in Chicago is down 9.75 cents at 3.76 3/4. The December contract 3.97, down 10.5. September corn.